Welcome back to the third series of Unlocking the SDGs, a blueprint for the future. In this podcast, we explore the UN Sustainable Development Goals, or SDGs, and what they mean for society. I'm Professor Monica Lackenpaugh, Professor of Integrated Community Child Health in the UCL Great Ormond Street Institute for Child Health.
And I'm Professor Preeti Parikh, Professor of Infrastructure Engineering and International Development at the Bartlett UCL School of Sustainable Construction. In this episode, we are discussing the relationship between the Sustainable Development Goals and climate change. Goal 13 calls for urgent action to combat climate change and its impacts. And many people have argued that tackling climate change should be the highest priority of the goals because of its impact on all of the other targets. Today, we'll be exploring the roles of universities like UCL in addressing the climate crisis and what that can mean for delivering against the rest of the goals.
Our guests today are Professor Catalina Turku, Professor of Sustainable Built Environment, Bartlett School of Planning, and Professor Ilan Kelman, Professor of Disasters and Health in the Department of Risk and Disaster Reduction and Institute for Global Health. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Hello. Professor Turku, UCL recently sent four academics to the Bonn Climate Change Conference, and you were part of the team. What was your mission at the conference and what were your experiences?
Thank you very much for the invitation, and I'm delighted to participate and be part of your podcast, especially around these two themes, Sustainable Development Goals and Climate Crisis, which are very dear to my heart. And to answer your question now, yes, I was one of the four lucky academics to be representing UCL at the Climate Change Conference in Bonn. For those of you who don't know, this conference is the more technical conference, which prepares the groundwork for the COP conferences, which take place at the end of the year. Usually the UNFCCC has two such technical and implementation conferences. One is mid-June and the other one is the week before COP starts. And they lay down the foundations for the discussions at the COP. So this participation at the Bonn Conference built on my previous experience at COP. So my first COP experience was COP28 in Dubai. And building on that experience, I think I was on a mission to follow three particular topics around cities, adaptation, and research and systematic observation. So on cities, COP28 in Dubai, we had for the first time a day allocated to cities. And cities have been there in COP discussions for a while, probably starting back in Glasgow at COP26. However, they don't feature very highly in the discussions at the moment, despite their important role in implementing some of the COP decisions. And I've written a very short piece on this in the Bartlett Review about the three key roles cities play in localizing some of the COP decisions, which are mainly around the fact that they are platforms for systemic and ambitious transformations. They play a role in governing the climate crisis. Therefore, they should be acknowledged as subnational governments. And they also should play a role in the way the different funds associated with the climate crisis, such as the Loss and Damage Fund and the Adaptation Fund, are actually allocated to nations. So despite these discussions, the cities are, as I said, not very much talked about in COP negotiations. And I think that highlight in Bonn was during the first week when the CHAMP Association, which stands for the Coalition for High Ambition Multi-Level Partnership, launched this UN Habitat report, which highlights the need for greater emphasis on urban priorities. The second topic I followed throughout these negotiations, it's around adaptation. We know very well that a lot of work has been done around mitigation, but not much on adaptation, especially in relation to cities. So the discussions have started to pick up in Bonn, and there are already discussions around a framework of indicators to measure this global goal of adaptation. And the questions I've been raising there is whether we are going to see any alignment, for example, with the SDG framework or any post-SDG frameworks. And the third topic I followed, which is very dear to me as an academic and as a researcher, is research and systematic observation. So the role which research plays in informing these processes. And I have to say that I've been sitting at the back of the room, smuggled into the informal meetings and listening to specialists and negotiators biting my lips. And there is still a lot of disagreement, for example, on the research needs, gaps, capacities across region, or the role that big reports like the IPCC report should play in informing COP processes.
Thank you so much for sharing your experiences both at COP and Bonn. And I think you rightly highlight that we're going to see population growth in our cities. So thinking about our future cities, adaptation plans, how to finance those, but also how to make our cities more resilient is going to be key. And I've had the pleasure of accompanying you to the previous COP, which was in Dubai. But we also have Ilan with us, Professor Ilan Kelman, who I know works a lot on risk disaster reduction, but he does not participate at COP and Bonn. And I was wondering why that was the case.
No, hello, thank you. And it's actually really exciting to hear the different perspectives. My interests are varied and I like connecting. So I'm half at the Department for Risk and Disaster Reduction, half at the UCL Institute for Global Health, the idea being to connect disasters and health using many different connectors, one of which among many is climate change. So when we consider all the vast connections, all the ways these topics are interlinked, there's so many international processes going on. To simply focus and dedicate so much time and effort to one of them would neglect the others. Because we know that human-caused climate change is one challenge among many which we face. And it's not per se a cause, it's actually more a symptom. When I try to connect disasters and health, including climate change as a bridge, it's trying to understand these baseline causes. Why do we behave in such a way that we end up changing the climate rapidly and substantively, as well as so many other changes? So when we think about the fact that, as Catalina said, there's these two Bonn meetings, they're at least a week each, then there's a COP, there are a couple of weeks, that actually adds a lot of time, including the preparation and the recovery and the follow-up. So why just climate change when there's all these other topics? The other element, of course, is that the climate change COPs are so popular. Everyone seems to want to go. So why should I necessarily? Resources are limited. I personally don't have a lot of interest in turning up to a 200-euro night hotel in Sharm el-Sheikh or Dubai, yet others want that. So fair enough. When there's limited resources, let those who are excited about it go for it. And I'm happy to learn from them, including from Catalina, who attends, and you, Priti, you've attended, as well as taking a remote perspective and saying, what can we achieve when we're not actually physically present? How can we ensure that we get the outcomes and promote the ideas without going through these 16 or 18-hour days, which others have to experience?
So would you say in some way there's an inequality here that we're presenting, that everything is focused, a lot of money, a lot of value to the COP, but there's not that equality with the other SDGs?
This is part of the challenge. We always know there's never equality, there's never equity. And this applies to the SDGs, but definitely beyond the SDGs, because SDGs themselves are so limited. And I think this is an open question which people are researching and we don't have answers. Why has human-caused climate change ended up dominating so much? And why are people so focused on human-caused climate change when we not only have the other 16 SDGs, but we have all the topics which aren't covered in the SDGs?
Yeah, I would like to add to that. I fully agree with Ilan here. And my mission at the COP, so it took me about a year to work it out. It's actually to lobby for the fact that climate is not an island. The climate crisis is not on itself. We have many crises around. We have the biodiversity loss. We have pollution. We have land degradation. And that's my mission, to actually spread the word that it's not only climate change, it's also all the other SDGs. And it's not the climate change which impacts on the SDGs. We well know that SDGs like poverty, inequality, health, and so on impact on climate change and these relationships. So my mission actually at this COPs is to open up that discussion a little bit and take into consideration the bigger picture. And I think this should also be an area of research where we should contribute. I think that why we put so many efforts into these processes, COPs and SBs, which stands for subsidiary bodies, so are the technical and implementation machines behind the COPs, it's because the way these international organizations work, so the UNFCCC, which is the UN Framework for Climate Change Conventions, is very nicely linked into this political processes and negotiation processes, which is the COPs and the SBs, and really nicely backed by the IPCC reports and other very strong scientific assessments. While other processes, for example, there is the UNEP, for example, which works on other assessments. So the Global Environment Outlook Assessment I'm involved with, which is not so nice, which looks at the complexity and the multitude of these crises we have to deal with, not only climate crisis, but they are not so nicely linked into a international policy process. So that's why I think we talk so much about climate crisis. I fully agree with you. It's not only the climate crisis. It's much more. And this is, I think, what we should have. We need to open up and think about other things as well, not climate crisis, climate crisis. And once we do that and transform across other areas of human activity, climate crisis will probably have better outcomes.
What is particularly interesting with all of these different processes is the climate change one is aiming for a legally binding treaty. The SDGs are not, the Sendai framework is not, the urban agenda is not, all the other ones, including the Addis Ababa one on development funding, are not legally binding. So again, exactly as Monica raised, we have inequality. Why is climate change elevated so much in the international system when human-caused climate change is a symptom, not a fundamental cause?
And I like your point about opening multiple doors and exploring those interlinkages. So at UCL, I've been leading a piece of work on identifying links between sanitation infrastructure and SDGs, which Monica has very much been part of this work from day one. And there we identified synergies between sanitation and 130 out of the 169 targets and all 17 goals, which shows that you need good infrastructure systems to deliver on sustainable development goals, including climate action. And this once again shows that interconnection and the value addition of multiple kind of disciplines and interventions to address some of the big grand challenges facing us.
Which really brings me to a change maybe in the way the government's presenting the position. So it was good to see recently that the UK's ambassador to the UN, Dame Barbara Woodward, she actually restated the government's commitment to the SDGs at the UN Assembly. And she did talk about multiple things such as global poverty, political instability, and climate change, and that these were core parts of that mission. Now, that's maybe a change for us. Just wondering, do you really think that is just a speech, or do you think it marks a change in policy priorities given the UK's lack of progress, as we know and we've actually discussed in this podcast, against the goals in recent years?
Yeah, I welcome that speech. There were other important things mentioned in that speech. So the reference to local leadership, which is very dear to my heart, again, coming very closely to how we govern and look after our cities. Also acknowledging the link between CC and other crises, so like the biodiversity loss, pollution and land degradation, there was a mention there. And of course, the importance of mobilizing some of the climate finance, which we need to bring about these transformations and mitigate and adapt to the multiple crises. In the lead to the elections, I was poring over the two party manifestos and I was a little worried that I don't see much reference to climate, low carbon, sustainability. The main reference was around environmental, nature, greenery. But I have high hopes. We have a good minister at Miliband for the Department of Energy Security and Net Zero. And we have a very ambitious ministry, Angela Rayner, for the housing and communities. And I'm referring to these two because I'm looking very much at the sustainable housing target, SDG 11.1, and trying to understand how this will work over the two ministries. So hopefully, fingers crossed, things will work out over the next 4 years. In terms of how well we've been doing, I think that UK has been lagging behind for a long time now. So we've been pioneering for the first time climate change into national legislation with the 2008 Climate Act, but not doing really well since. And this is probably coming from the fact my research shows that SDGs are very much seen in relation to developing contexts in this country because they were very much driven by two ministries associated with development work, the Department for International Development and the Foreign and Commonwealth and Development Office. The other problem we had with SDGs was that it's very a reference to how these targets and indicators could be localized and implemented at the local level. And just to sum up is that they are traditionally in the UK associated with developing contexts. So if there is that culture saying we do not need them, they are not relevant to a developed context such as the UK, looking at the SDG target 11.1 sustainable housing, inadequate housing in this country, that's the contrary. So you really need them. And if we start to measure some of these outcomes, they really don't look well. There is very little awareness at the local level, at the municipal level. So there have been other priorities such as Brexit plans, climate action plans and recovery plans following the COVID. And there's been a lot of lack of funding to try to understand research-wise or implementation-wise and unpack these SDGs.
I mean, for me, it's good to hear thinking about the wider issues and connecting them. My question to anyone promoting any government policy, how evidence-based is it? So I'm not too concerned that major parties did not emphasize low carbon. Greenhouse gases are not just about carbon. There are highly potent greenhouse gases, orders of magnitude worse than carbon dioxide, which actually don't have carbon. And so we need to be thinking about low greenhouse gas, or even better, low pollution. It's ironic that dealing with climate change, which is about reducing greenhouse gas emissions and increasing their uptake, offers nothing different than standard pollution prevention. So why are we separating climate change, even a different SDG, rather than just saying, you know what, how about low pollution? How about stopping pollution? Or fair enough, we need to specialize. We're talking about climate change. Don't talk about carbon. Talk about greenhouse gases. Similarly, when we talk about phrases like climate crisis, climate emergency, climate chaos, where's the evidence that these phrases are useful? First, it's actually not climate. It's human-caused climate change. Second, it's not about the climate per se, because if we deal with it, then we're going to be okay. The point is we don't deal with it. It really comes from fundamental human values, attitudes, behaviors, and approaches. So when a government person gives a speech, are they talking about climate and climate change and what the environment is doing to us? Or are they saying, you know what, it's us. We have to change. And then, of course, this crisisification is very despairing. When people say, well, we're all going to die and it's a climate crisis and, oh my goodness, wave our hands and say it's like an emergency. Well, people do feel despondent, which is understandable. As mentioned, it's not a framing which is really evidence-based. And we do have to be worried. There is no doubt we are changing the climate and the wider environment quickly and substantively, and we should not be doing it. On the other hand, there's so much that we have to offer. So where's climate hope rather than climate grief? Where's eco-inspiration rather than eco-anxiety? And this is the evidence basis. We've come so far in past decades and centuries on pollution prevention, on trying to deal with disasters, on recognizing what the issues are with humanity and how to solve them. We have so much to offer and a long way to go. So let's say we are in trouble. We are causing problems, but it's us who are the crisis. It's a crisis of human values and attitudes, not of climate or environment or biodiversity. Or if we actually want to be really honest and really evidence-based, it's not just a fossil fuels and oil companies crisis. It's actually a human overconsumption crisis.
But do you not think, just being devil's advocate here,
of course.
Do you not think that when we use evidence-based language, we're talking really to ourselves? And when you're out there talking to communities, the public, you want to attract their attention. So there is a translation of what we find, what's evidence, and then translating that into a marketing speak, just to say it that way, is you know, if you don't put that drama on it, is anybody actually going to listen to you?
Well, the climate crisisification hasn't worked. We're heading into COP29, and they have not been every year. They have been going on longer than many activists have been alive. And we've now started the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change 7th assessment. So we have the evidence that the crisisification focusing on climate, human-caused climate change has not worked. Then the question is, what is the alternative? And if we're going to say eco-grief, well, eco-hope is the same number of syllables. If we're going to say climate crisis, climate hope is actually fewer syllables. If I ask the public, do you want lower taxes? Do you want a healthier life? Do you want less stress? Well, I can give you those solutions. I don't see that as speaking to ourselves. It is evidence-based, and it's also trying to bring on board people in a positive, active, realistic approach. It has to be balanced because we don't want to go out and say, oh, I'm going to offer you this element of hopium, right? The fundamental baseline of hope. That's just unrealistic. Because there are problems. People are suffering. Even in this country, it's devastating the number of families who cannot even put enough food on the table. So going out and saying, oh, climate crisis, climate emergency, climate chaos, isn't going to engage them. It's not going to help them. As opposed, again, do you want to pay lower taxes? Do you want your kids to be safe? Do you want food on the table? Connect the topics. Solve people's daily concerns on their terms, exactly as you're saying, Monica. And by definition, we actually stop human-caused climate change on an evidence basis.
And this opens up a good question around the role of universities. So yes, we do the science, we look at the evidence base, but clearly there seems to be a piece around science communication and engagement and how we engage on this topic, the language we use. And I mean, one of those would be conferences. And I'm going to come back, Catalina, to you to talk about your participation in the Bonn Climate Change Conference to discuss a little bit about the benefits of academic engagement in those kind of events and forums where you'll have stakeholders from public sector, private sector, civil society.
I think that universities more generally, but again, this is my view because it's very much framed by the area of my research and because I work very much on providing evidence to policy making processes, I think they have a role and should take a role into these processes. And I think that UCL over the last couple of years under the leadership of the Grand Challenge Climate Crisis has made important strides. And we are starting a discussion around a lot of the topics. So you'll be seeing more on that. Watch out this space. For me as an academic, so last year was the first time I was involved in a COP. I went through a three-phase kind of experience. The first couple of days were baffling. The whole process seemed as a black box. I couldn't get my head around. I didn't understand where the different things. However, you go through this first phase and you go into the frustration a couple of days when you start asking yourself, how can I help? What am I doing here? I'm disagreeing with a lot of the things that are said here. These are things which have been studied and we have evidence saying or answering to these questions. Why do we need to discuss them again? And then the third phase came, which was towards the end of my first week in Dubai, which is a quite humbling experience because you see all these problems on the table. They are big, they are frustrating, they are baffling. But then you start to reflect on what you know and what's your knowledge and try to understand how your knowledge actually fits into these processes, what it fits, which makes you reflect on your work. And on the basis of that, I kind of think that there are three categories of academics going to these processes. And I think they all have their roles. And as an academic, being in one of the categories, you have certain benefits which come into your research and the wider impact you make. I have to say these processes are not for ivory towers academics. They are for academics who are interested in getting involved in these processes. So the three categories for me are the diplomacy academics, who are the people who speak loud, who care about how the science gets into these processes. They talk about hope, they talk about anxiety, they are very vocal and very fresh and very powerful, but you have to have certain skills and you have to communicate in a certain way with certain types of scientists who already advise in these processes. So you have to be able to engage in that dialogue. Perhaps here at UCL, we are not great. There are a number of individuals already doing that, but this is something as a scientist we should get better at if we want to get involved in these processes. There is a second category of researchers who are really interested in studying the processes on the power dynamics between the different actors involved in these processes and how they influence these processes. And they do that in order to understand how to benefit these processes and how to make them better, work better, have better outcomes. Think about perhaps the food on the table for the most vulnerable. And there is a third category of researchers where I think I kind of find myself, who are really interested about the gaps, the needs, and the capacity across regions. What is really needed? How my knowledge can actually support and provide the evidence for that policy process to get better?
Thank you. I mean, no, that's really insightful and helpful. And certainly in a process where shouting the loudest is heard the most doesn't, to me, epitomize equity, equality, justice, or what we're aiming for. I also do find within academics, a lot of those who are shouting the loudest, whether it's a COP or in other venues, tend to be those who are least ingrained in climate change science. I mean, we talk about all these strange phrases, and the latest I heard was climate obstruction. And I respond saying, how do we obstruct the climate? I didn't get an answer. And even a simple phrase, I mean, we know it is perfectly accepted in climate change science that the number of tropical cyclones, hurricanes, typhoons, and cyclones, that number is decreasing because of human-caused climate change. That's accepted. I mean, there's no debate in that. Intensity is increasing, but number is decreasing. I've thrown that statement out a few times and had incredibly adverse reactions from scientists, even trying to explain the basics that actually we can deal with disasters if we want to. There's no such thing as a natural disaster because it comes from us and our choices, political power and resource allocation. And people still say, but all disasters are increasing because of climate change. And we know that is not true. Then there's a phrase, well, all weather is getting worse because of climate change. And my response is, well, aside from the tropical cyclones, climate change is global warming. How is cold weather getting worse under global warming? And these simple, straightforward, fully evidence-based statements upset a lot of people who are shouting the loudest in climate change realms, including climate change scientific realms.
We've touched on a few things, really building on what you came to talk to us last time. That was more on how to achieve the goals in a warming world. And today we're really talking much more about the global community, interlinkages, the need for these interlinkages, and the need for us to consider things interacting with each other, really, and not in their silos. And it's going to be interesting when we have the grand challenges, of course, we've now got it for climate, and how that's going to address some of your questions, really, about the inequity and inequality, etc. My next question really is about this interlinkages. Do you think the global community is starting to understand how interlinked these issues are, or is that just something for us to talk about in this room?
I hope that we can take this far, far beyond this room, exactly as we've all been saying to the COPs. Please, Catalina and Priti, take it to the COPs, as you are doing, and also ensuring that the public is on board. I don't see a lot of change over recent years. A lot of people, again, will put out oh, we have to connect, we have to link. And particularly when the COVID-19 pandemic started, the amount of material being published saying we've now have all these crises, COVID-19 and climate change and biodiversity, and they're all linked and we need to do something about it. And that was it. There was no real understanding of what the links were, if there were really fundamental links. There was no explanation of what is a symptom and what is a cause. There was no suggestion on constructive ways forward, apart from, of course, green reconstruction, post-pandemic recovery, which addresses human-caused climate change and biodiversity. Plenty of ideas, plenty of plans, and we have not seen that action. How do we draw people together? How do we make these evidence-based links? This is a challenge, and it's easy to criticize. I mean, after all, I've done a lot during this podcast. Where are the solutions? How can we be solution evidence focused rather than simply saying, actually, we've known these problems for 20 or 40 years and we're still promoting the same problematic approaches?
Yeah, I think I'm a little bit more hopeful about interlinkages. So I've been involved for the last 2 years in the so-called Global Environment Outlook Assessment with UNEP, which is due to be published in 2026. And this is a document. It's not like the IPCC report, but it's an evidence-based assessment which very much looks at these interlinkages. So we have a 140 team of scientists trying to work out how these interlinkages, we look at five particular systems, the environment, economic, food, energy, and resources, circularity. And we try to work out how these interlinkages will be actually driving forward transformation. What I want to say is that interlinkages are there, but they are so, so tricky because they are complex and it's very difficult to get your head around as a policy maker or a decision maker because they are complex, so they don't necessarily churn out an outcome or output you'd be interested to measure as a somebody on the ground. But I think I have hope. People have started to think about them. We have the discussion around negative-positive tipping points, positive-negative loops, feedback loops feeding into the different systems. And there is an understanding, at least at the UNEP level, that we need to do something about them and we need to somehow measure them and show them how important they are in transforming systems. But I think the literature on interlinkages has been growing over the last 10 years or so. And it's also related to other bodies of literature around the SDG frameworks on localization, because I think one of the problems we have with interlinkages is because they are so complex, and then it's the discussion on how you collapse them down to the implementation level. So it's this discussion between horizontal, vertical, and multi-level governance processes which have to take on these interlinkages. So there is a lot of discussion around the localization and how we localize interlinkages, when at where we stop to look at an SDG and how it links across what kind of boundaries. And I think that's also feeding into the third body of literature at the moment, which has been starting to emerge as we speak around post-2030 SDG frameworks. So are we going to see more SDGs, simplified SDGs? And there you have very much a discussion between continuation and transformation kind of advocates. There are people who say the SDGs frameworks are still valid. We still need to measure to ensure continuity, but we have to get better at measuring and acknowledging the interlinkages. So it's not enough to deal with climate crisis. We have to look at other things, inequality, poverty, health, and so on, partnerships, how we work with each other in society, and so on. And then you have the transformation kind of scholars who say these SDGs haven't worked. It's too complex. We need to bring in other things like digital transformation, inequality, and inequality, geopolitics, health security, and climate change, for example, make these things bigger and transform the SDG framework.
I like your optimism and the use of word transformation, and I hope that the interlinkages provide a pathway for that. And I want to bring the conversation back to the fact, and Ilan, I think you speak about this quite eloquently, that this is human-caused climate change. And we are responsible for it. And in effect, it means as people, we have the power of addressing it. And we've seen that outside this room, outside academia, over the last few years, there has been an increase in grassroots activism from groups like Extinction Rebellion and Just Stop Oil. Do you think outside academia, we're seeing a shift in people's willingness to speak up?
I don't sense a lot of change. When I do speak to people and try and promote these interlinkages and understand their concerns, a lot of the reaction is that those who are in the groups dealing with climate change activism are seen as elitist and separate. They are also seen as causing immense damage to these issues and to what actually interests people who are struggling day to day. How does damaging art support environmentalism? They admitted that they made a huge mistake in stopping and disrupting public transportation lines. And we didn't need academics telling them beforehand that to support climate change, you might want to support public transport. They also promote a lot of the scientific myths, which we mentioned earlier. And when they do so, even people who are on board, means that scientific understanding is regressing. We have to enjoy the freedoms that we have. We absolutely have to be acting on these challenging issues. But what I've seen with the groups mentioning is that they're not helping extensively. So why are the activists screaming and yelling without an evidence basis? When in fact, if we want to convince people to act, we have the evidence basis that it's not about climate change. And I think Catalina was absolutely right. These interconnections are difficult. They're complex. That's the role of scientists. Not to publish our 40,000 word papers or 400,000 word books. I mean, we love that. But it's our job also to communicate better these interlinkages and the difficulties and the complexities, rather than just saying, oh, well, it's hard. Because we do have the ways forward. And part of that, I'm curious, Catalina, with the global environmental outlook, when we look at, say, three COP processes, climate change, biodiversity, and desertification, how much influence do you think the global environmental outlook has on those three COP processes compared to the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change?
I do not think they have a big, big say because they are not linked into a political process. So the IPCC is linked into the COP process, which is very political, so it has a big voice. The interlinkages from the geo assessments are there, but they are not necessarily linked into a political, so it doesn't really have a voice. It's something I am putting forward and keep saying, you know, we have all this very interesting discussion and very complex discussion here, but we actually do not fit into a political process. So, but that's maybe something for places like UCL to bring in some of these people and start that discussion and make that discussion into something bigger and put it on the politicians' table. And I'm working on that. Hopefully we'll bring some of the UNEP people to start that conversation. I think I would like to bring up another point. People, humans, the human race have been very bad at partnering with any other species. We've destroyed everything, so we are really bad. We think we are exceptional and we'll come up with a fix to whatever problem is. I think slightly of a different opinion. I think we should consider the environment and nature as an equal partner with agency at the table of negotiations on climate change. It's not human agency, it's natural agency. This is some of the ideas I'm trying to filter into the GEO report. It's a very strong idea and it's very new to acknowledge nature as one of the partners, as one of the stakeholders. It's something other cultures, indigenous cultures, for example, and Eastern philosophy has worked with for millennia. So people in China, India, and other countries, the Amazonian forest, they work with nature. They see nature as an equal partner and it needs to be that fine balance achieved. So I think that's something we can learn from other cultures and bring back into the Western civilization. I also think that the fossil fuel is mainly our problem. It's the problem of the Western countries, developed countries. And I think I'm finding it difficult to justify it for countries in their early stages of development, where perhaps they do not have any other options. Perhaps they need to subsidize fossil fuel because that it's the oil which runs their economy and put on the table the little food for the vulnerable. I'm not saying that's justified. I'm saying that us, as the developed part of the world, we should help these nations to come up with alternatives. I agree, fossil fuel needs to be stopped because it's causing global warming. But again, we have an inequality there. And how we are going to deal that with that and how we are going to support those who have supported us through millennia to get to the level of development we are at today to actually go over that threshold. So I think it's a very political, sensitive discussion. And I think us who have the resources and tools and the finance are not very good at putting forward in this discussion. So a lot of the difficult negotiations around, you know, stopping fossil fuel, it's coming for that friction between countries in a certain level of development and developed countries who can perhaps afford very easily to say we do not support fossil fuel industries. I do not have the solution. I think we should stop, but something we should think about.
And this is so wonderful to hear because this is exactly what we need. It is so often absent from the climate change discussions. To me, it's not about us telling them.
No.
It's actually we can learn from everyone. And the countries who may be seen to be less developed, if we like that language, actually have so much to offer us. It's an exchange.
Fully agree.
And so what you say about the global environmental outlook is wonderful. The climate change panel has struggled to include indigenous, vernacular, local, traditional knowledges. They've been asked for years and for some reason can't have an approach, even though we can offer them plenty. The IPCC's definition of climate justice is entirely human-centric. And of course, IPCC is an intergovernmental panel. Scientists appointed by their governments, it is a political process. So it sounds like maybe we need a more of a global environmental outlook and less of an intergovernmental panel on climate change.
Well, it sounds like both our leads for the grand challenge of climate crisis, Professor Lisa Van Haller and Professor Mark Maslin, are really going to have a lot to do. They're going to need to talk to everybody, bring the interlinkages into that, really be quite inclusive in this dialogue. But maybe, Ilan, you also want to suggest changing it from climate crisis to climate hope as well.
I would definitely avoid phrases climate crisis, climate emergency. The crisis is part of it. It's an overconsumption crisis. It's a human values crisis. We need action and the evidence is there. Why don't we talk about simply eco-hope and eco-inspiration, which by definition encompasses climate rather than focusing on only climate.
So I look forward to the narrative changing and let's see where this goes.
And I look forward to seeing more research on nature and people positive solutions, moving away from a very narrow siloed focus. Thank you both for joining us today. Where can listeners find you online?
I have three places. It's the UCL SDG Research Accelerator, which is one of the research initiatives under the Bartlett School of Planning. And it's also the legacy of UCL Cities Program Stockholm, which collects all the research around these topics, but also the active, proactive policy support and engagement and the different public dialogues we are engaging with. The second place will be my LinkedIn profile. So I'm trying to keep it quite alive. And the third place will be my short pieces or postcards in the Bartlett Review and other media outlets.
And for me, Ilan here, really just do a search on my name. You can find me over a good proportion of social media, for good or bad. I'm on LinkedIn, I'm on X, I'm on Instagram, I'm on Mastodon, I'm on Blue Sky, I'm on Threads, and I have a Psychology Today blog. If you like old approaches, I actually read my email, so you're welcome to email me too. I look forward to learning from you, and please interact so that we can all do better together.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. You've been listening to Unlocking the SDGs. This episode was presented by me, Professor Preeti Parikh.
And me, Professor Monica Lakhampool.
And produced by the UCL SDGs Initiative and edited by Frontier. Our guests today were Professor Catalina Turku and Professor Ilan Kelman.
And if you would like to hear more podcasts from UCL, subscribe to UCL Minds wherever you download your podcasts or visit www.ucl.ac.uk/SDG. Join us next time on Unlocking the SDGs.